Louis XIV ruled France from 1643 to 1715. That's more than 70 years. Still, how did he have the time to invade the Spanish Netherlands, battle the Habsburgs, extend the French dominion to eastern Canada, impose national authority, build the French navy, and engineer the extraordinary gardens at Versailles when he was always in the bedroom? Lady Antonia Fraser writes tantalizingly around this question in her latest book, Love and Louis XIV, The Women in the Life of the Sun King. Earlier this week, before he totally lost his voice, Scott Simon spoke with her. And a heads up, Scott's voice is very rough in this interview.
Let me ask you about that relationship that he had that cemented his ideal of women, his relationship with his mother. Louis XIV's birth was considered something of a miracle at the time it occurred.
Yes, he was given the name Dieudonné, given by God, because his mother, Anne of Austria, she was married at 14, and she gave birth to Louis when she was getting close to 38. And this was a time when people did not have late babies. People were considered to be over the hill by the time they were 30. But when Louis appeared so healthy and marvellous, I mean, I think it was the greatest thing that ever happened in her life.
I want to ask you about his first love, Maria Mancini, who was not regarded as one of the great beauties of the court, but he was touched by her intelligence and her personal regard for him as opposed to regard for the monarchy.
Yes, and Marie was an interesting character. As you say, she was not considered a beauty. She was very thin, which was not desirable at that time. Marvellous dark eyes from her Italian inheritance. But what really charmed Louis was she opened his eyes to literature. She adored Corneille, Le Cid, you know, and the idea of chivalry expressed in the Cid, and love and honour and glory and beauty and renunciation. And of course, she wasn't considered good enough to marry him. She wasn't a great princess. So she found, alas, poor Marie, that there was love and honour. Then there had to be duty and renunciation.
Louis married Marie Theresa from the Spanish throne, and if I could get you to tell us the story of how they literally inspected each other from a distance.
The Infanta, that's the Spanish for princess, Maria Theresa, was actually Louis' first cousin, and she was the greatest match in Europe, the daughter of the King of Spain. The Spanish court was so formal, she wasn't even allowed to receive his letters before they were married. Her father, the King Philip IV, said there would be a time for that, and just took the letter away, the most respectful letter, you know, could have done no harm. And he wasn't allowed to meet her before they were married by proxies. But being Louis, he decided he'd have a look, and so he went to the door as a stranger and sort of had a look, and she was tipped the wink, that man is actually your fiancé. I mean, it's extraordinary. And they were going to be in bed that very night, you know, very different from our own day.
It's safe to say that it was not a happy marriage as a marriage.
It wasn't a happy marriage, but as royal marriages go, it wasn't actually unhappy. There were such terrible marriages around. I mean, he wasn't faithful to her, remotely faithful to her, but he was nice to her. He was fond of her. The trouble is, he was bored by her, and she wasn't the sort of person he wanted as Queen of France. He wanted a glorious figure at his side. As he was going to be the Sun King, he would like the Moon Queen.
You write several times about the fact that Louis XIV was a very serious monarch. He was not one of those monarchs who viewed it as his dictum to simply play all day, but he was very serious about statecraft.
A complete contrast to his first cousin, our King Charles II. They were first cousins, but in council meetings, Charles II was always yawning and sending notes, when can I go hunting, and I think my dog needs me. Louis XIV, on the other hand, was an obsessional worker. I mean, he spent hours in council meetings, and a great one for detail, the detail of army manoeuvres, the detail of taxes. So he had a lot of energy and also a sense of duty. He did not think he'd been put on the throne of France by God to idle.
I want to ask you about Louise de la Valliere, and help us explain how she wound up at the French court. It was, in those days, for a young woman of her station, almost a choice between a nunnery and the court.
Yes, there was no such thing as a job for a young woman of her station. She had no money. She was of good family, but quite minor. So the only kind of job she could get was either to go into a convent, and for that you needed a dowry. You had to take money with you into a convent. She didn't have any. So she got a job in the household of Louis's sister-in-law, Henriette Anne, Duchesse d'Orléans. And while she was there, Louis was having a sort of flirtation with his sister-in-law, which his mother really disapproved of. She considered it to be incest. You know, it wasn't technically, but not what his mother said. So they worked out a ruse, like plays of Molière, who was the court playwright, that Louis would pretend to be courting Louise, who was adorable and 16 and had a crush on him. Actually, he'd be courting Henriette Anne. But of course, as in all the best plays, he really fell in love with Louise. She was his first mistress.
Contrary to what we might think, that romantic hijinks, if I might put it that way, were accepted with a wink and a nod at the court. You suggest in this book the church took a very serious interest, and even disapproving interest.
Yes, that was a surprise to me as I began my researches, because I'd imagined, as you put it, that, you know, a nod and a wink. To a certain extent, when the king was young, there were some nods and winks. But all the time, the great leaders of the church, people like Bishop Bossuet, were thundering away in sermons. The whole court were gathered together, including the king, and the preacher preached just before Easter. And Bishop Bossuet had a famous trick. He'd say, "I denounce the king for adultery," and everybody drew in their breath with horror. He said, "King David in the Bible." Well, everyone knows King David committed adultery, so you can hardly say you can't do that, you know. So it was a sort of game of cat and mouse.
A sadder episode in the king's life is he was 40 and a triumphant warrior, and he developed an infatuation for a young girl of 17 or 18, Angélique.
Angélique de Fontanges, said to be the most beautiful woman ever at the court. She doesn't look so beautiful to me, but then we have different standards. And she thought she was going to be the new Athénée, she was going to be the mistress. But unfortunately, she did have a child. That wasn't unfortunate. But in the course of the childbirth, she got terribly badly damaged, really. Childbirth was pretty crude art at the time. And she died, very sad.
Yeah, but she did make the king weep, which was considered almost unprecedented.
Unprecedented that the king should weep. He had this extraordinary control. And I think when he saw this lovely young creature, not yet 21, dying, and her child also dying, I think he probably confronted just the black side of his behaviour, you know.
We live in a time when people are fascinated by, this week it's Britney Spears and, what's his name, Kevin Federline, Splitsville.
Yeah.
And people are measurably by the millions are fascinated by that. Can you trace that fascination back through the preoccupation that the public used to have with the royals and even to this day?
Yes, I think that the word celebrity, you know, there have always been celebrities and they used to be royals in an age before stars. And royalties were the people who people gawped at and had views about, of course, and had rumours about and satires on.
I guess I didn't quite appreciate until reading your book the degree to which people in that position lived public lives, the way the court would leak information like a sieve, the way everybody seemed to know something about them.
Well, I think conditions change, but human nature doesn't change. And I think leaking like a sieve, saying, "I'm in the know, and if you treat me well, I could let you know a thing or two, and that Louis XIV, I can tell you, in the bedroom," you know, all of that. I think this is very human, and we're just like it today, except the circumstances have changed.
On the whole, you consider Louis, I think you say, the ultimate compliment of the age was a civilized man.
Yes, if being extremely nice to women and inferiors, which is everybody. He was never cruel. When one of his courtiers insulted him, instead of doing what many kings would have done, he broke his own stick and threw it out of the window, saying, "Lest I be tempted not to behave like a gentleman." And he treated his former mistresses with great courtesy, continued to visit them. He adored his mother. Yes, he's certainly a civilized man in that way. And it's a tragedy for him and was for France that his militaristic ambitions, which he planned to put France in the centre of the world, they went fine for a bit, but towards the end of his life they went much too far and led tragic consequences of deficit and bankruptcy, so that was very sad.
Lady Antonia, very nice talking to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Lady Antonia Fraser, author of Love and Louis XIV, The Women in the Life of the Sun King, speaking with Scott Simon earlier this week. That was before he lost his voice completely. To read an excerpt from Lady Antonia's book, go to npr.org.